You know, I like to use a pattern to carve out, you know, an intricate and specific design on the face.
Not me, man. I like to hack and slash and let the creative spark guide me as I go.
Doesn't that kind of look weird when you put the candle in?
The candle?
Yeah, you know, you cut open the top, scoop out the innards, and then you put the candle in.
Dude, no. Scooping out the insides makes way too much of a mess. I usually just carve up the face with a butcher knife.
I do not get your method for carving a pumpkin.
Oh, you were talking about a pumpkin.
Beer?
Are you and happy haunting to all of our diabolical digifiles out there. Welcome to another blood-curdling episode of Digital Noise right here on oneofus.net. This is, of course, the Blu-ray DVD review podcast that never, ever hands out floss or bags of pennies. Because fuck those people.
Maybe we should take a minute and try and figure out what our giveaways are going to be this week, then.
Put the pennies away, Chris! Damn it! Well, I am your ghastly host, Brian Salisbury, and with me in this dimension, and probably the next, is my sinister co-host, Christopher Lawrence Cox.
The creepy carnivorous Christopher Lawrence Cox.
I like it. I like the alliteration. I want to say a big thank you to Mr. Aaron Jeffers for the horror movie version of the digital noise theme you just heard.
Not to mention, just in general, being the theme master of oneofus.net. You know, does he have his own, on our about page, does he even have a little bio thing?
Yeah, no, okay. I've listed him as our resident composer.
Okay, good, because he deserves it. That guy puts in a lot of work.
Absolutely, and we want to thank him definitely for that. And we'll probably end up using that theme for other things down the road. Anyway, I do want to remind you that Digital Noise, just like all of our content at oneofus.net, is available on iTunes. All you have to do is search One of Us in the podcast section. And while you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? We've decided that once we get more of those reviews, we're going to start reading them on the air of our various shows. So get those in quick.
We are?
I don't know. We'll do.
We decided my best interest. How do you know what my best interest is?
I have no idea what your best interest is.
How can you say what my best interest is?
Who are you?
When I recorded this digital noise, I did it in my living room.
Oh, Lord. I feel like there's a Dickies album starting or something. What's going on here? Anyway, I also want to remind you that the Podcast Awards are currently seeking nominations over at podcastawards.com, and you can make nominations every single day in categories like movies and film and entertainment that Digital Noise might be perfect for.
No-brainers.
And then, of course, there's the culture section or the entertainment section for shows like The Original Gentleman.
Just saying. And there's sports?
Sports section for Inside the Locker. I mean, all you got to do is go over there and put in the name of the show and a link to it, and you can do that once per day, and we'd really appreciate it because, well, we work our asses off.
Have they run? I don't think they've gotten to the actual voting part yet. They're still in
nomination. They're in the nomination phase.
So the 16th, I believe, is the date when they start going to voting, where you can do it once per day.
Oh, okay.
You can only nominate once, but you can vote once per day. So once that, after the 16th, just get your ass in there and vote every day, assuming we make the nominations.
That would be awesome.
You'll see at that point what stuff we actually, if it was anything, we qualified for. So
we shall see. You can also follow us on Twitter at DigiNoiseCast and, of course, on Facebook. Facebook.com/... I should learn this.
Look, I can hover over it on my thing.
Okay.
It's digitalnoise.oneofus.
Facebook.com/digitalnoise.oneofus.
Yes.
I will get that at some point in the future. Anywho, it's time to reach out and let someone touch us via
the letter box.
You've got mail.
That's right, Torgo. Thank you so much. And our first question, of course, these are all, I love that once October rolls around, almost all the questions automatically go to horror movies, because why wouldn't they?
It's the best month of the year.
Totally. This one comes from Brian Brennan, who asks, there are a lot of specific horror genres, be it slasher, ghost, possession, or monster movie. What is your favorite specific horror genre, and what is your favorite film in said genre?
Wow. That's a hard one to really say, because it's so mood-oriented.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the mood for just, so much splatter, it's funny.
Yeah.
You know, I don't tend to like splatter movies when they're deadly serious, with the exception of the Italian giallo films.
Sure.
But like stuff like Evil Dead 2 or Dead Alive, those sort of like, just so much blood after a while, you just start laughing.
Yeah.
That's fun. Sometimes I'm in the mood to be specifically creeped out, in which case I want a possession or a ghost movie. I'm not really as big a guy into the slasher films. I know that's your thing.
Oh, yeah.
On the whole, and monster movies are so, I mean, they're just, there's no telling. They could be so many different types of films.
Yeah.
It's not even a specific thing in and of itself.
You can tell how nerdy we are about horror because it's really hard for us to answer this question.
It's next to impossible. But if I was going to say, like, the genre that I will watch, even if I'm pretty certain it's going to be terrible ahead of time anyway, is usually ghost movies.
Mm-hmm.
I just, for whatever reason, the ghost thing, you know, you never know. And I'll like a movie to a certain degree that everyone else will hate just because it's got ghosts in it. I'm
sure.
Weird like that. I've taken a crap from Martin before on it a number of occasions. He's like, I don't even listen to you when it's a ghost movie.
I will watch contemporary ghost movies, even though they're not a specter of what they used to be.
Oh,
boy. I mean, if I'm really being honest, like, I'm with you. I think it's entirely mood oriented. There are very few types of horror films that I won't watch. But I think if I'm being completely honest, it would have to be slasher just because of my personal history, I guess, with the genre.
All the bodies you've left in your wake.
Yes.
Yes.
Maybe. Let's not talk about that.
Totally.
I plead the fifth. But I think Halloween is going to be my number one. Ooh, but Black Christmas is really good too. No, it'd be Halloween. I think Halloween would be my favorite slasher film. So if you were going with ghost movies, if that was going to be your number one, I'm not saying that it is.
That's where it's hard, because it's like there's too many options at that point. You're like, okay, Poltergeist is a very strong possibility. Of course.
True story.
The Shining is mm-hmm. very, very, very strong. But The Shining isn't really completely a ghost movie either. It's like, what is that? I don't know.
It's like an isolationist madness movie or something.
Yeah, I mean, is it about a guy going insane or is it a ghost story? Although technically there's one event that happens in that film, only one, that can't be rationally explained. And that's Jack being let out of the freezer.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only thing that can't be rationally
Somebody
explained.
Actually had to let him out.
Yeah.
And there was no one around to do that.
And at that point, why would the kid or the mom have let him out of the freezer? That doesn't make any sense. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. But probably if I was going to say, okay, strictly speaking, ghosts, probably Poltergeist. But, you know, there's The Sixth Sense. There's the original version of The Haunting. There's I could keep going. But anyway, you get it. Yeah.
Well, then you're going to hate this next question, Chris.
Oh, God.
This comes from Cameron Russell, who says, if you could make a Halloween movie set comprised of only three movies to watch every year to celebrate the holiday, which would you choose and why?
Well, first off, who the fuck are you that puts me in a situation where I'm only allowed to watch three Halloween movies?
Cameron, we appreciate
from now
your question.
Till the end of time. Are you telling me that you've got some elaborate plan to abduct us and drop us off on an island with a Blu-ray player and only the three movies we choose now? Because if so, you just try it, buddy.
Please pardon my curmudgeonly partner, who apparently is off of his meds today.
I don't like this hypothetical question.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and play devil's advocate. If you had to pick three movies for you personally to watch, let's rephrase it, for you to watch every year that would, I don't know,
which best
epitomize the season.
Okay, so, boy, obviously, The Breakfast Club.
Sure.
No, not The Breakfast Club, I'm sorry. No. Fools Rush In. No, not fool.
You're a horrible person.
I know. This is as hard. This is like even more difficult than the last one because you're asking me to reduce Halloween horror movies down to the three best ones.
Well, not necessarily. Like for me, this question really comes down to what are the movies that I go back to every Halloween that kind of sum up my Halloween. And for me, those movies
I can name it: Halloween, Trick or Treat, and well, I don't know what the third.
Well, yeah, you got the first two: Halloween, Trick or Treat, for sure. Wow, actually.
Season of the Witch?
Season of the Witch might be on there, although, I don't know, it'd be Halloween, Trick or Treat for sure, and, gosh, now I'm at a loss.
There are so few movies to choose from that take place during Halloween.
Yeah. You know what? No, I think for the last one, it would have to be either The Exorcist or Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Like, those really, for me, are like, okay, this makes me think of creepiness at the season and what this time of year, just the general ookiness that even people that don't like horror movies tend to gravitate towards. And either one of those movies, you don't have to be a horror fan to appreciate either one of those movies. So,
yeah, fair enough. I mean, like I said, I mean, I think if you're doing it in the terms of to celebrate the holiday are the key phrases, mm-hmm. the key phrase there, part of your phrase that I'm looking at, I guess, I mean, obviously Halloween and Trick or Treat for sure. But I'd probably just say Halloween and Halloween 2 because they're kind of one movie, really.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's like, a good point.
We were reviewing or doing a commentary on Halloween the other day. I really, there was that point. I was like, you know what, guys, come on, let's just go ahead and do Halloween 2.
Just make it one really long commentary.
It's like that moment with Donald Pleasance at the end. You're like, you can't stop watching this now.
Put the other one in. Put the other one in.
I know what happens, but I got to see it again just to make sure nothing has changed.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, guys, thank you so much for your questions. We're going to go ahead and close the letter crypt.
Except for Cameron Russell. What the fuck?
Oh, come on. I'm gonna go ahead and call it the letter crypt for now. We're gonna go ahead and close it, and we're going to shamble our way into the reviews. And fittingly enough, we are starting with the movie The Purge.
Why is that fitting?
I don't know. It's a horror movie. Plus, we're purging it from the list early because I did not particularly care for this film.
It's funny. I feel like I'm the only person who did, and yet it made a fucking mint in the theaters.
Well, so. as you well know, unfortunately, you do not have to be a competent horror film anymore to make a shit ton of money.
Well, that's true, but you know, horror movies make money regardless.
True.
But I actually enjoyed The Purge. It's not a classic or anything, but it is exactly what it sells itself as a micro-budget exploitation horror, basically, just with slightly better production values and a decent lead actor in it.
Mm-hmm.
Ethan Hawke here in this near future, specifically 2022.
Yep.
Is a wealthy home security salesman who's got, of course, I mean, he lives in a nice neighborhood in San Francisco, which is, you know, you're wealthy then, you know.
Right.
I mean, you're wealthy if you live in a shitty neighborhood in San Francisco. You live in a nice one, fucking forget it. But he made his fortune selling home security systems. And the reason for that is because apparently this, you know, I mean, this is one of these, like, you have to suspend your disbelief right from the get-go that this could even happen to even watch the rest of the movie. And if you can't buy it, you might as well turn it off, which is this thing called, titularly, The Purge, which is once a year, everyone can do whatever the fuck they want, including murder and rape and whatever. So home security systems of the sort of like medieval castle variety, but with modern technology, have become a top dollar item in rich neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So he's doing very well. But of course, there's always that level of resentment because everyone who lives there, they're like, act real nice to him. But at the same time, they're like muttering under their breath around him because they all know they couldn't live in that neighborhood without these security systems. And he's got a monopoly on it there.
Sure.
But of course, you know, this is the night in this case of the movie that the event is going to happen. No big deal. Close it down and everything. Except, of course, the problem is that the littlest kid lets in a rogue person who's wandering outside begging for help. And they're like, what the fuck are you doing? You let in this guy who immediately takes off and disappears inside their cavernous house. And the people who were chasing him show up and go, look, here's the deal. We have a lot of stuff that we know exactly how to tear down your security system, and we're going to come in and kill you all unless you let us have that guy.
Yeah.
Moral quandary.
Yeah. They're oddly set on killing this homeless dude. They're just like, he must be the only homeless person in the entirety of San Francisco because they get all incensed that they won't let these crazy people in masks kill this homeless person.
Well, I will say that, like, you know, I mean, this has been going on in this point in the movie by long enough, and the purge for that evening has been going on long enough. It's like, you know what? The rest of the homeless people have probably made good their escape by that point. Or like, you know what? Let's go to LA for the day.
Yeah.
Or wherever. Let's find some place to hole up. The fact they've got one and they know where he is enough for them to be insistent. And it's kind of, I mean, the whole thing is a very hyper exaggerated statement about like the class divide ultimately. So if you can separate the politics from at least a little bit, which are hammers you over the head with it, I actually had fun with it in terms of just being a home invasion, a futuristic home invasion film.
I mean, I like the concept, and I agree that there are moments that are fun. There were just, I don't expect this movie to be airtight when it comes to, you know, when it comes to the story, but there were things that were happening that were just so insanely stupid, and things like, especially within character dynamics that I just didn't understand, that I was like, okay, if I don't give a shit about you anymore because you keep doing things that are not necessarily stupid things, but things that don't make sense for any person in a situation, then I'm like, okay, I'm kind of getting taken out of this. Also, there's the fact that The Purge suggests that America will be a bloodthirsty hellscape of violence in 9 years, and I call bullshit because Florida will do it in 3.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't it already? We just haven't actually legislated it yet.
Right.
But, you know.
No, I actually did enjoy that as a concept. And I thought it also, in addition to the class structure and the class struggle, was making a comment about our inherent predilection toward violence, no matter what end of the spectrum we come from.
And I don't disagree with you that, like, yes, there are moments where there's character behavior that seems a little, that you really have to stretch to imagine that anybody would behave the way they did. Certainly I was taken out of the movie by those moments, but I also really liked ultimately where the movie came with what it was saying about the class structure, which I really can't say anything about
without spoiling
it. But I thought there's some really fascinating statements that it makes at the end that leaves you in a state of actually having to think about this whole scenario and the things they're trying to say about our society now. Like, you actually have me in a position that I don't know exactly how I feel about all this,
right,
which is a pretty fascinating thing for something, a sci-fi horror movie to be able to do to you. Like I said, I liked it for what it's worth, but I can see, I can definitely, you know, understand some of the complaints.
And I wasn't going into this with lofty expectations. Like, I wasn't expecting this to be a glorious film or a film of high art. I mean, I was expecting a studio horror film with a high concept and not much else. And it was that. But there are just things that I can forgive a lot, but it reaches a threshold with me where it's like, it's so dumb, I can't get behind it anymore.
Fair enough.
Well, that is The Purge, you heard, and we are going to move on to Europa Report.
Were you calling our fans a herd?
You heard with Purge. The next movie we're going to talk about is on the list, and it is called Europa Report.
And of course, exactly the moment my computer stops making stuff work. That's just retarded. I'm sorry. What is going on here?
Stupid Europa Report, what breaking all the computers.
Is going on here?
I blame Charlton Copley myself.
You know, I'm going to say right now to people who went out and saw Gravity already and are like, want to get a taste for something else with like pretty realistic on the whole, like space tension stuff with astronauts dealing with the space adventure. This is it. This is the one you want to go pick up. And yeah, it's no Gravity. Mind you, that's a massive work of art, I think. This is a pretty cool little thriller that manages to stay hard sci-fi pretty much all the way through it. The idea here is that it's the first crewed mission to Europa, which is one of Jupiter's moons that, sure enough, in real life, is pretty much the only place in our solar system that scientists take seriously the concept that there might be life on the planet. It's
wow.
Surrounded by a thick ice crust, but apparently because of the nature of the thermal magma, whatever shitty stuff. Anyway,
yeah, I don't know. Don't look at me like I know science.
There's heat underneath it.
I'm a film critic. I don't know.
There's heat underneath it, and there's all the right ingredients to possibly have life, believe it or not, underneath this thick ice crust. So it's even plausible that this is a mission that we would, you know, in 50 years or 100 years might send out there to investigate if there was life. And this follows it with the context of sort of like, it's kind of like you're watching a documentary based on found footage. So it's like, you know, all the various ship's logs and the cameras that are everywhere in the ship, and then interviews with people back in mission control, including Dan Fogler, for some reason, who's playing a completely normal scientist in it. And you're like, why is he in this movie? but he's really good for his role. But the whole thing is like, okay, you're watching a documentary after the fact, and it seems that they make it clear enough right from the beginning, something is going to go horribly wrong with this mission.
No. The hell you say?
What a shocker. And, you know, it's, even with that being known, you're actually fascinated with the way it's detailing the science, with the quality of the special effects, with just wondering what is it, because the scenario as a science geek is fascinating enough already. And you're like, please don't turn this into just like a bug hunt movie. And it's not. Although I promise you, it does on some level involve life that's not human.
What the deuce you say?
Just barely. But it's one of those films that doesn't really qualify as a horror, even though it has certainly scariness to it, but it's more sort of about the nobility of adventurers who go into scenarios knowing how incredibly dangerous they are, but that like, if it's for the betterment of all mankind, for the you know, improvement of what knowledge we have in a way that will significantly improve what we know about the universe, these people are willing to give their lives gladly for that knowledge. And that's inspiring. At least I find it very inspiring. And so I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was pretty good all the way through. It's a crew of about 6 astronauts, and some actors are better than others, but overall, there's never a moment I felt taken out of it.
Nice.
Yeah. There's a certain amount of bonus features on here that mainly focus on, like, the special effects stuff. Like, there's a visual effects look at it, which is actually, like I said, pretty well done, including how they did the weightlessness and stuff. And then the music, which was excellent, and it was by Bear McCreary.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Who always does good soundtrack.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, this is recommended for those people. I mean, you know already from what I've said whether or not this sounds like your type of movie.
Whether gravity pulled you in or not will be the litmus test for whether you will like Europa Report.
Jesus.
What? Oh, hey, that was a pun. I didn't even realize.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
I'm sure you didn't realize, you son of a bitch.
Well, while Chris is making much ado about that pun I just made.
Oh, God, here it comes.
Let's move on to the meaning of... No, I'm kidding. Let's move on to Much Ado About Nothing.
You know, it's fun. This one, we actually got to interview the several of the actors from this, Clark Gregg, Nathan Fillion, Alexis Denisoff.
Yeah.
And that was good times.
Yeah, we were losing our minds. Yeah. Like, all of these constant Whedon collaborators just sitting,
Which I believe we're putting the video of up on the site, right?
That is the plan, yes.
Okay, assuming it works.
Assuming it works.
But this was the film that Joss Whedon made when he apparently was like, had leftover energy after making the Avengers. I don't, you know, apparently it was one of those like there was a weekend in between like filming and editing. Like that they're like, he's like, all right, guys, come to my house. We're just going to knock out this movie, this adaptation of Shakespeare. And he, of course, did what Joss Whedon does. He opens up his little black book and calls all his old friends to come in and be in this, you know, Shakespeare comedy, which I think is pretty cool as a longtime Whedon fan. This has got Amy Acker, Alexis Denisoff, Nathan Fillion, Clark Gregg, Reed Diamond, Fran Kranz, Sean Mayer, and Jillian Morghese, most of which, all but I think, like Jillian, have been in other shows, other Whedon shows.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a bigger cast than that, too, but those are the main people we're dealing with here. The story is pretty much exactly the same. The text was changed a little bit here and there, but on the whole, they're speaking original Shakespearean dialogue. It's just moved to the modern day setting, which has a lot to do with two characters, Beatrice and Benedict, Amy Acker and Alexis Denisoff, who are people who can't stand each other, but are basically tricked into falling in love with each other while there's another wedding preparing to happen at this house.
You know those Matthew McConaughey, Kate Hudson movies where the two people, and not just them, but a lot of romantic comedies you see where two people can't stand each other,
yeah.
But wouldn't you know it, they come together at the end? Shakespeare invented that!
He did. He invented everything.
Yeah. And this is actually one of my this is probably my favorite Shakespearean comedy, right up there with Taming of the Shrew. I just find that his banter in Much Ado About Nothing is not only funny and charming, but even if you're not a big fan of Shakespeare, even if you've never found yourself able to get into the dialect, I feel like it's the most accessible.
And Whedon is doing a not unheard of interpretation of it here, taking it like a screwball comedy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen a theatrical production of this before that was very much going in the same direction he was, of taking a lot of these sequences and blocking it out so it involves, you know, stuff the Bard did not write,
yeah.
But that involves a lot of, like, you know, very physical comedy. And Whedon proves that he's actually pretty good at that, unsurprisingly, considering he spent so much of his career showing chicks beating the shit out of supernatural creatures. And what have you.
Well, it's funny. There's a great documentary on this Blu-ray about how this came together. And it was that even before the Avengers started, he would just get people over to his house to read Shakespeare.
Yeah.
That was just a hobby.
It was a regular thing that they would get together for weekends. They'd all have some wine or beer or whatever. And they would read through a Shakespeare play.
So basically what happened here is he was just like, oh, I really liked it when we did Much Ado About Nothing. And, like, while they were finishing The Avengers, he had one of his assistants, like, run across the street and buy a copy of Much Ado About Nothing, and he's looking back through it, and he's like, yeah, I think this should be the one that we do as a movie. So, that's kind of how that came together. And I actually really love their interpretation of it. I think it was a lot of fun to watch, and they really nailed even the heavier character moments, despite the fact that it's clear that they're all having a blast doing this. Clark Gregg is amazing in this.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's Clark Gregg.
I mean, to a lot of people, I think they've only seen him play one type of character.
Yeah.
And this is the movie that I think that you should watch if you really want to see him step outside of himself.
And this is, and keep in mind though, this is an experiment. It was never a film they intended to be a big hit or anything. They made it very cheaply. They made it very quickly, and they made it after lots of time having with these friends read through this play in the past before anyway, all being Shakespeare fans and, you know, over time coming up with their own sort of interpretation of the material. And yet there's that thing that he does when he works with actors that he already has a connection with, where he manages to make the whole thing feel so organic and natural and flow with such a sense of general camaraderie. It's just fun to watch these people have at each other over the course of this thing. And of course, that to some degree depends on whether or not there are people out there just like, look, I just can't watch Shakespeare. I don't get it. I listen to his lines. I get lost. Fair enough. I'm not criticizing you. No. It can be difficult sometimes to understand what Shakespeare is talking about.
Absolutely.
Fortunately, this has subtitles, which helps greatly.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you do like Shakespeare and you do like his comedies, this is a completely valid interpretation of it, and it's a really fun one. No one's ever going to list it among the all-time classic film versions of Shakespeare, but it's certainly one that you should check out. And if you're a Whedon fan, you should definitely check it out, if for no other reason, that there's this sort of subtext going on underneath the whole thing with the relationships between some of these characters, specifically between Beatrice and Baxter, Brad...
Benedict,
thank you.
Baxter, Brad.
I didn't remember. We played by Amy Acker and Alexis Denisov, who on Angel were sort of doomed lovers. And here, you know, he's put them in those roles of these characters who hate each other, but eventually, you know, are going to get together. That has a sort of payoff for fans who always wanted that to happen on Angel and never got to see what they wanted.
Yeah. And the other, there's another great feature on here called Bus Ado About Nothing. Just about this, about them renting a bus and driving from L.A. to Austin for South by Southwest, and just all of them just piling into a bus and having fun on this 25-hour road trip, and all the videos that came from that, and all the, the whole time I'm watching it, like, why don't I hang out with these people?
I will say, though, if, like I was, like, moved to L.A., and Joss Whedon's like, I want to be your friend, I'd be, like, really excited, right? Like, I want to be Joss Whedon's friend. I want to be friends with all these people. And he's like, hey, why don't you come on over? We're having a big party this weekend. And I got there, and they're like, now, let's all sit down and read Shakespeare together. I'd be like, ah, fuck.
Duly noted. Duly noted. But, yes, if you're a Shakespeare fan, and especially if you're a Joss Whedon fan, I kind of think this is a must-have.
Agreed.
Awesome. Well, from Much Ado About Nothing, we're going to go to the meaning of life. So from Much Ado About Nothing to the actual meaning of life.
What does it mean?
Why are we here? What's God all about?
Or should we just drink beer? Well, tonight we're going to prove it right here. For tonight is Digital Noise.
I like it. We're going to cut an album.
Yes, this is Monty Python's Meaning of Life, the 30th anniversary edition, because as you know, with home releases, every 5 years, you have to, by law, re-release whatever film is in your catalog.
Absolutely.
It is a law. And Monty Python's Meaning of Life is one I am not sad to see get this treatment, because every time, you get a little bit extra.
It's a little bit more.
And I'm
a little bit more until you burst!
I'm fine with that. And this includes all the, first off, Meaning of Life is, of all the Python films, the last one that they made altogether. And it's a sort of an anthology, really, just with like a sort of bookending sequences in a way. That's supposed to be like, yes, them saying, here's chapter by chapter, all the parts of life from birth to death to afterlife. And doing sketch comedy a la Monty Python's Flying Circus, but with a much bigger budget of detailing these parts of their life with lots of, like I said, once again, run through, running jokes, things like this. And it really is a masterpiece of comedy to me. While as I still hold that Life of Brian is my favorite Python film, this was their most polished film and their most professional, to be sure, and easily, I think, the second best of them all. Yes, I know, Holy Grail fans, calm down. You just haven't spent enough time watching the other ones, that's all.
Nope, still Holy Grail.
Nope. No, it's not. I love Holy Grail, don't get me wrong. But anyway, there's all the old extras are here, of which there's a considerable amount of old extras that are thrown into this thing. But the new ones are, or at least one of the new ones, is what you really make this worth your while. First up is a 30th anniversary reunion with all five remaining members of Monty Python that is over an hour long, just barely over an hour long, which is pretty fucking cool, if not a little depressing, because they are all just old as the hills at this point.
It's going to happen to all of us.
Eric Idle is simulcasting through a television set, but they have it set up so it's not really that bothersome. They tend to be able to hear each other pretty well. And they talk a lot about stuff that they didn't use in there, a lot of which you can actually see in the deleted scenes. I had never gotten a previous Blu-ray edition of this, so I'd never seen any of the deleted stuff. There's a ton of whole deleted sequences, like, you know,
nice.
Whole segments that were never ever used. You're like, wow, that's pretty fucking cool. Stories about Graham Chapman, as always, who's known as the Dead Python. The fact that most of these guys are old and can barely remember what the hell happened. There's a lot of, like, Cleese points out at one point, he's like, you know, and you can't tell if he's being serious or if he's fucking with the rest of them, but he's like, it's funny the way how we can remember two completely different things. But well worth your time. It's a little chaotic, but it's a lot of fun. Ultimately, this is one of those essential, at least, watch films and plan on watching. I mean, like, there's a lot of films you're like, okay, just ran it on Netflix. But this is one of those ones after you watch it, you're going to wish you had this version to watch with the significant amount of quality bonus material that comes with it. Because you just won't want it to be over when it's done. And that way you just get that much more.
Yeah. Right on, man. That is the meaning of life. And even though it's... So how many times previously have they released this on Blu-ray?
Well, actually, I'm not sure if they did release it on Blu-ray. It's been out on DVD several times.
Oh, right on. That is The Meaning of Life, the 30th Anniversary Edition Blu-ray. And from there, we're going to move on to a movie that's experiencing its 40th anniversary on Blu-ray. And that is The Exorcist.
Scariest movie ever made, still.
It is.
I don't care what anybody says. This is
terrifying.
The scariest movie ever made. Nothing has ever surpassed it.
It is terrifying in so many ways. In overt ways, in subtextual ways, in subversive ways. There's stuff that, you know, subliminal ways. Like, there's all kinds of stuff going on in William Friedkin's The Exorcist. Now, this release is... Okay, how to put this? This is sort of the king of double dips. What we have here are a couple of new features. One is called Beyond Comprehension, which is William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, and then one called Talk of the Devil. And beyond that, there is a booklet in here that is a personal memoir by William Friedkin, which is really cool. And it's like it's a thin hardback book. So it's very different from most of the stuff you get. When you get a booklet, it's usually, you know, it's a paperback.
Yeah.
It's softer. But this is, and the case is really beautiful. But on the whole, you're getting everything you got when this was released in 2010.
Which was a very nice release at the time.
It was. I mean, you're getting the director's cut as well as the theatrical version. Now, a lot of people have griped about the crab walk in the director's cut.
I don't understand what people don't like about the crab
walk. It's freaky. The only complaint that I could possibly have is I think it happens a little too early. As far as, like, the progression of Reagan's possession, if it had happened, like, there's literally a scene where I was like, if they'd put it here, it would have been perfect. But it does kind of throw a lot at you and then kind of backs off and then it gets really intense again. But I love that scene.
I guess it might be because for me, I had seen this movie five or six times by the time I saw the version with the crab walk. So
yeah.
By then it was like, that's just really cool.
Oh, it is. It's absolutely amazing. And I'm so glad that scene is back. I have no complaint about that scene being there at all. But again, I think this particular release, which is the Blu-ray, DVD, and Ultraviolet all together, is really for people who don't already own the Blu-ray. Because there's just not enough here to justify spending more money to get another Blu-ray. And I don't think this is going to be necessarily a cheap Blu-ray. So, again, The Exorcist, an incredible film.
Oh, yeah.
A film that it's eerie to the max. It is a movie that will give you nightmares. It's a movie that seems to exist in a nightmare. And yet, it's one that doesn't feel like it's using dream logic. But every once in a while, you just catch a glimpse of something and you're like, wait a minute.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Are these people awake? Am I awake? What's going on? It's a terrifying movie. Absolute masterpiece. But again, I think this is a release, this 40th anniversary edition, is a release for people who don't already own it. That said, if you don't already own it, you really should pick up this release. The casing is beautiful. The transfer is really solid. There is some grain, but that's never going to be a deal breaker for me. especially with movies like this, is I like to maintain some semblance of the idea that I'm watching a film, like on 35.
Yeah.
So a little bit of grain is never going to be a deal breaker for me.
Both these new extra features are ones that are about the author, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. William Peter Blatty.
Yeah, and this does contain a lot, almost all of the supplements that came on the 2010 version, so you're not getting cheated out of anything by buying this one instead of the other one, but again, there's just not, in my opinion, there's just not enough here to justify, if you already own the 2010 version, buying also buy this one.
Yeah.
But again, if you don't, pick this up, because it's about to be Halloween, and if you don't have a Blu-ray copy of The Exorcist, you're doing Halloween wrong.
Agreed.
All right, well, spinning right around from The Exorcist, we're going to talk about From Here to Eternity.
You know, I've just, this is nothing to do specifically with this film, but one of my favorite musicians is the artist Nick Cave, who was originally in the band The Birthday Party and later just Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. I still say the best title for a love song ever was his song From Her to Eternity. I was like, dude, that's awesome.
Well, nice.
Even though From Here to Eternity, as much as most people have never seen it, seem to think of the famous scene with Burt Lancaster and Deborah Kerr rolling around making out as the ocean surf rolls over them. Like, oh, this is a romance film. Man, this ain't a romance film. Holy shit.
See, I've never seen this, so that's surprising for me to hear.
This is some dark shit. Oh, my God. This one...
It's not called From Cheer to Eternity.
No, it definitely is not. In fact, apparently the title refers to... it sounds like it's like, I will love you from here to eternity. But that ain't what it's talking about. Now, this has a great cast I already mentioned Burt Lancaster and Deborah Kerr, but it also has Montgomery Clift. His love interest is Donna Reed. Frank Sinatra is terrific in this movie. Ernest Borgnine, George Reeves has a small role in this film. And it won 8 Academy Awards out of 13 nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. So this is a classic that, like, you know, was on my list for years now. Films I feel a little guilty for not having seen.
It's a blind spot.
But it's not there anymore. How about you, Brian?
I've never seen it.
Damn it.
No, this is still in my blind spot.
Yeah, and it's well worth your time. Now, ultimately, what this really is a just before wartime flick.
Okay, so pre-war.
And it's very critical of the military, while at the same time, I don't know, it's one of those, I haven't really completely finished thinking about this and all the things that it's trying to say, because it's a very complex narrative, but your 3 main characters are, first, Montgomery Clift, who plays Robert E. Lee Pruitt, who is a master bugler, you know, the guy who plays taps and reveille and all that, who apparently left his corporal stripes, going busted back down to private and a previous outfit, because he was replaced as first bugler out of nepotism. Like, some guy who's clearly not as good as he is. And he's got an ego. He's kind of an asshole, quite frankly. But he comes to the Hawaiian, you know, this is like 1941.
Before it was a state.
In Hawaii?
Even. Yeah.
1941, you say? That won't play into any historical stuff.
I wonder what happened.
And then Michael Bay flew in.
I wonder what happens.
Bomb. Sorry. So he gets there and he's just like, I just want to be a soldier. I like soldiering. I like being a soldier. I'm like, I don't, you know, whatever. If you let me play the bugle, that's fine, but I just want to be a soldier. And they're like, yeah, but you used to be this great fighter. And so we want you to join our boxing club here. If you do that, we guarantee you, you'll be corporal again in no time. And, you know, we really need you. And he's like, look, I'm not fighting anymore. And the reason is because he basically almost killed a guy and can't get over it. Despite the fact in every other way, he seems like a guy who wouldn't give a shit. That shit kind of broke him. And he's like, he just wants to be left alone at that point.
Right.
The problem is that the guy who's in charge is a douchebag and completely manipulative.
Wouldn't you know it?
And orders everyone under him to basically endlessly harass this guy. Just give him shit constantly, to treat him like absolute dirt, to make him all do all the trashiest jobs. And, you know, the guy in question is like, Montgomery Clift's like, fuck it, I can take it. Do whatever you want. I'm still not going to fight. You've also got Burt Lancaster, who's a first sergeant who sees what's going on and is participating somewhat, but also doesn't really approve, because he can't stand his commanding officers making these decisions, partially because he's in love with his commanding officer's wife, played by Deborah Kerr, who he's having a secret affair with, even while knowing that if they get found out, he's going to basically, they say he'll be sent to Leavenworth, but I'm like, you get sent to prison for having an affair with a commanding officer's wife? Military has some weird laws.
Fuck, man.
I know. And then there's Frank Sinatra, who seems to be the one guy who actually gets along with Montgomery Clift, mainly because he's a complete loser himself. A likable loser, but one of those guys, when you put a beer in front of him, he's instantly drunk and acts like an asshole everywhere he goes, but a kind of a lovable asshole.
Gotcha.
And as this goes along, it's watching all their lives get more and more tense, more and more pressure on them to make a decision in their lives, to make a choice, to make a choice for change, and all of them resisting those choices for change, and how that resistance ends up not only leading to like chaos in their own lives and tragedy, but ultimately, as the not too vague metaphor at the end, Pearl Harbor, America going, we don't really want to enter the war. I don't know if we want, it's a war. We're not really sure we should be involved. What? We got bombed. Fuck that. We're going in.
We will destroy everyone.
This actually is a great movie. It's, I mean, I can't, can you imagine me trying to defend saying this isn't a great movie at this point?
It no.
would be difficult. Like, yeah. Hey, here's the guy who thinks From Here to Eternity sucks. Can I go now?
I've got business in the other room. Excuse me for a moment.
But this is, you know, it's a beautiful looking transfer of this on Blu-ray. It's got a picture-in-picture track, which is weird for a classic film. You never, ever see that. You usually see that on, like, new releases, and especially animated films or big-budget superhero stuff. But for like, a classic movie, that's just odd. There's audio commentary. There is a couple different vintage pieces, and there's a collection of 5 collectible lobby cards, like postcards, that come with it. All in all, not the most elaborate set ever put together, but not half bad either.
All right.
And this is like one of those ones, it should be on your list of stuff to watch.
It's definitely on my list of things that I should have watched by now. So there's that.
You're bad.
I am. Well, moving on, From Here to Eternity, we're going to go to American Horror Story Asylum.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
And this is my pick of the week, just saying it.
Well, yeah. I mean, and it's so great that this has come out in the Halloween season, because it's such a great show to watch right now.
I can't believe this. See, if you guys remember back on our old show, I believe there was a review of American Horror Story the first season, which Brian announced this was absolutely terrible.
No. Let's not get the facts wrong. What it was is it was a casual discussion on Leog, in which you guys were talking about American Horror Story, and I mentioned that I had stopped watching it after a couple episodes because it didn't grab me.
I thought we reviewed this on remote viewing.
If we reviewed this, I had not gotten a copy of it nor seen it, so okay. I don't know why I would have been saying anything.
Fair enough. But regardless.
But my opinion of it wasn't very high from the 2 episodes that I had watched in the first season. That being said, when I heard that each one of these seasons is a completely compartmentalized story, that piqued my interest.
And I love the idea that it's something you don't see. It's I forget the term for it, a traveling company type of deal.
Like, yeah.
It's a company of players.
Like a troupe.
Yeah. A troupe of players and, you know, creator who regularly take on a completely different story and completely different characters that
similar
don't
to
cross
the,
over at all.
Yeah, similar to the Edgar Wright stuff where he takes the same people, Nick Frost, Simon Pegg, Bill Nighy, a lot of those same guys, and makes them, you know, gives them completely different characters to play in a completely different world.
Yeah. Yeah, so, at least as far as that goes.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't compare it in any other way.
No, not at all.
But what this creator of the show,
Ryan,
what's his name? Ryan
His name is Ryan, I know that.
That guy.
The guy who created Nip Tuck.
Yes. Ryan Murphy. Yes. He does shows that are very over the top. They're very in your face with all the elements, the genre elements that are there. And so far for me, the one thing that's really worked for me that he's done it with is, in fact, American Horror Story, in that he's creating the show that is, it's like throwing everything at horror. It's like,
yeah.
It's not enough that Asylum is a story about, like, a bunch of evil nuns and priests running an asylum, like, mid-century. who are abusive and one of them is performing experiments on the people. No, that would be enough.
Yeah.
But no, we've got aliens abducting people. We've got serial killers.
What looked to be werewolves at one point.
Kind of werewolf mutant people.
Yeah.
And that's just, oh yeah, there's a demonic possession.
Yeah.
There's just, I mean, it just keeps going.
You could play a drinking game with this show called, Spot the Subgenre.
Yeah. And it's funny. The reason this works is because there's like less than 5 minutes per scary thing that happens in the show, for one thing. Like, I mean, it just, there's no long, boring sequences ever on the show. It just bang, bang, bang.
It will not allow you to be bored.
No, it will not. And yes, is it corny? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's corny. is it almost laughably silly at points? Yes, but guess what? It wants to be.
Yeah.
This is camp, but it's camp done with absolute arms firmly embraced around the genre elements it wants. It's never making fun of these elements. It loves them.
And in fact, like, all that is true, but it's also shot with such a gorgeous artistic eye. Like, some of the wide shots that they do and the overhead pans as people are walking down creepy hallways.
Gorgeous.
Amazing.
Amazing cinematography on the show all the time. And if that wasn't enough, you have some performances from some of these actors that are just startling. Jessica Lange, for two seasons in a row, and now it looks like three, I've already seen the first episode of the new season, Coven, is just so great, there aren't words.
you know,
oh my God, she plays the lead nun here in this asylum, and she goes through so many changes in character personality as the show goes along, and we get to see, like, her playing herself at a much younger age and being a completely different type of person. You're like, she's one of the best actresses we have today, and she has made a decision herself that this is where she wants to be as an actress right now.
Absolutely.
And why wouldn't she be? This show is all about how fantastic she fucking is.
And then, of course, Zachary Quinto in this, who is, I haven't spent a lot of time with first season, but in this season, holy hell.
Yeah. Have you gotten to his major arc turning point yet?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you go, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, like I said, it's silly, the things that happen in this, but everything is like, it's like an old serial.
Absolutely. That's exactly how I would categorize it.
Like, cliffhangers almost every week that are just insane. And the show goes so many absolutely, like, places no other show would ever have the balls to go.
It's a midnight movie, but not the midnight movies that are so bad they're good, but the midnight movies that it's like, wow, this is surprisingly good.
It's a ton of fun. I really can't. It's one of my favorite things on television. I personally liked Murder House just as much as I liked Asylum the first season, but it was one of those ones that was a little slower to get into because it looked like it was going to be a different type of show than it ended up becoming, really. Like, the first couple episodes, you're like, okay, this just looks like yet another silly horror show.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before I figured out, wow, this is a really silly horror show and I'm liking it. This one right from the get-go is like from the first episode, you know what this season is going to be all about.
Yeah. Right from the get-go, when this is not really a spoiler because it doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the plot and I won't even say who it is. But when a pop star gets murdered, I'm not talking about a pop star in their universe. I'm talking about an actual pop star from our world is playing a character who gets murdered. I was like, okay, what is going on here? I have to see more of this.
It's odd that, like, this season kind of has tiny little flashbacks to modern day, like very small ones, as we bit by bit start to see the effects of what happened back in the 50s when most of the story was told. And it looks like the new season, Coven, is the exact opposite, where every once in a while we see a flashback of, like, turn of the century.
But it's all otherwise contemporary.
But most of it is contemporary.
Nice. Yeah, I highly, highly recommend this. You know what? I think this is probably going to be my pick of the week as well. I don't see anything on the list that makes me quite as happy as this did.
And of course, with extra features, you get about 3 minutes of deleted scenes on one disc, 4 minutes on another. There's a silly short where an orderly is being interviewed by an unseen woman, leading to disastrous results with bloody face. So basically a little, for all extents and purposes, it's another deleted scene, really. But, there is a 22-minute compendium of interviews and snippets from the season. There's a 15-minute look at the season's production design, which is indeed astonishing. So incredible. So gorgeous. Man, I just want to live in that asylum. Fuck it. I want that to be my house.
It's pretty awesome.
And then a 15-minute look at Tinsley Studios, which does all the makeup and prosthetics effects, which are also really good. This is one of those shows that makes you go, can they show that on television?
Yeah, I just thought of another subgenre that comes up in one of the episodes that made me so, so happy, which is the, like, the Christmas slasher film. Oh my God, there's a Christmas slasher film episode?
I'm sorry, but I'm not even a fan of Glee, but I love the fact that one of these episodes has a giant song and dance number just totally randomly in the middle of it. And you're like,
but even that makes sense.
That's so crazy.
Even that makes sense within its narrative. That's how well they've set up this completely bizarre world.
Agreed.
Oh, okay. Well, from American Horror Story Asylum, why don't we move on to The Guild, both the complete series and the complete series and season six.
Yes, they've just released season six, which is the final season of this American comedy web series written and created by Felicia Day, the queen of all female geeks. And the season six is the last one. So yes, you can get that separately, but at the same time, they've released it as one complete set where you can get them all just in one compact deal, which is cool because now I can get rid of my bigger, fatter editions and reduce and make room on my shelf. Very excited about that. But, now the story is about a bunch of web gamers or MMORPG gamers in a fictional, like, you know, it's basically World of Warcraft. Let's face it. That's what it is.
It's what it's at least based on.
Yeah. But it's, you know, they obviously can't call it that. And they, in the first season, they're just people who always were like part of this guild as part of it. People adventure together, but never actually met, but then end up meeting in real life and forming sort of weird relationships and sort of friendships outside of it as they get to know each other. Sixth season now, and the concept for this season is that the lead character, Felicia Day, has gotten a job with the company that makes the game, and she's like really excited, only to get there and find out they are all completely fucking insane. Like, the lead guy is so terrified of anybody who's, like, he's, alright, so, do you remember when you first started doing stuff on the net and you would just, like, read comments, oh, that's nice, oh, that's nice. What? He said I'm an asshole? Fuck that guy!
Yep.
Like, that's all he sees is the negative comments, and he becomes so afraid to do anything with the game, to change anything, or to more significantly add on this massive expansion pack that features an undersea world that they've been working on for like 5 years. He's so afraid to do it because he's afraid he'll get more criticism.
Right.
And everyone in there is like, look, you have to make him, you know, you have to figure out a way to make him do this. Meanwhile, of course, the moment the rest of the guild members find out she's working there, they all find a way to worm their way into the situation and just show up at the offices, causing no end of havoc. I mean, it's another fun season. It's probably, I think the last season was probably the best one, which dealt with them going to cons and actually had a huge amount of cameo appearances by pretty big stars in it. It was very funny, but this is still a nice ending to the series. It doesn't really try and do anything explosive with its ending. There's no big changes. It's very status quo for most of the characters here, but some of the characters get what they've been looking for, you know, get what they needed, even if it wasn't what they wanted, basically. And like I said, a nice ending. They ended it while you end it before it gets old. And that's the important thing. And this is the sort of thing that could have gotten old. This whole season is only an hour and a half, as in general. They're little tiny webisodes. So it adds up to about an hour and a half. Won't take that much of your time. And really, if you've never watched The Guild at all and you consider yourself a geek, especially if you consider yourself a fantasy role-playing geek, you've got to check out this show. It really is pretty damn funny, especially for that group of people with lots of referencing and, you know, off-the-cuff punning, like stuff you wouldn't even get unless you played these type of games a lot of the time. But you don't have to play these games to get it either, kind of the way that the League is for fantasy football.
So both the League and the Guild are good shows.
They should totally do a special League episode, the League versus the Guild.
That would be awesome.
I would love to see that. But yeah, I do recommend this, and there's actually a decent amount of bonus features on season six, which is nice as well, which I guess they should since it's like an hour and a half on a disc. You got room. So yeah, recommend it. I'm glad it's over, quite frankly, because it's like, okay, guys, it's probably time for Day to move on and do some. I'd like to see what she does next.
Yeah.
And this seems to have run its course.
Plus, it sounds like it ended before it got ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, before it got totally tired. It's like, okay, it's time to wrap this up.
Cool.
So, yep.
Well, right on. From there, we're going to talk about Robot Chicken Season 6.
You know, I didn't even start listening. I wouldn't even know what Robot Chicken was till Season 3. Like,
oh, really?
I had no idea what it was. I had heard of it and just like no clue what it was. And then I was literally flipping channels and I was like, what the fuck is this?
That's ironic because that's the whole setup of the show is flipping channels.
Exactly. Robot Chicken, of course, is an Adult Swim show that is basically run by, what is it, Seth Green?
Yeah,
is the other
Seth
guy?
Green and Matt Seinrich, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. But yeah, it's essentially stop motion animation using a lot of toys and action figures from, you know, these guys' childhoods. and setting up sort of humorous skits around the different worlds in which these characters live. And I've actually thought the show has gotten better as it's gone along. They've gotten a lot more conceptual with it. They've done some really neat things.
They're ballsier.
And they're really, really ballsy. And you know what? Their Star Wars stuff always makes me laugh. Like when they have specific Star Wars specials where they just compile, because they have so much Star Wars material. And when they start doing episodes devoted to Star Wars, I think that's when they're at their very best. Season 6 is really strong. I mean, it's a lot like watching an anthology movie, but a hyper-anthology.
Yeah.
So not every segment is going to work as well as the last. But when it hits, man, there was one particular in here where it's like I don't know where they got action figures of Orville Redenbacher and his grandson.
Well, it's become clear to me at this point they're just building their own.
I think a lot of these are built. But where they do like a Children of the Corn parody with Orville Redenbacher and his grandson, I thought that was hysterical.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, there's just little bits here and there all throughout this season.
If you don't like a bit, wait for 2 minutes and it will be something completely different.
Absolutely. I also like the one where the G.I. Joes actually go to Afghanistan.
I enjoyed Elliot going to the home planet with E.T.
Yeah.
And then E.T.'s just like, what the fuck, man?
Are you going to get a job?
Get off the couch. Lots of good stuff in here. Actually, the one that made me laugh the most was probably in the season opener, which just explains what the Starbucks logo is.
Oh my God.
I fucking holding my stomach laughing, but it's like anything else. It is hit and miss, but it hits so fast with stuff and so much of it is so good. You're going to find something in every 10-minute episode that's going to make you laugh out loud.
Yeah. And you can kind of see how this naturally kind of evolved from Family Guy, which Seth Green was working on, because it's like, they're cutaway jokes, but that's all the show is the cutaway jokes, but done with this really interesting sort of stop motion style that is really appealing.
It is the ultimate. It is the end all be all of referential humor. If you like referential humor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all it is.
Absolutely.
And honestly, it's that point where they're not trying to open this up to just anyone. If you don't recognize the source stuff, you're not going to get the jokes.
Right.
You know, you're really not. They're all based on your familiarity to some extent. And there's stuff in here I don't get. There was a bunch of Shirt Tales jokes this season. I'm like, I don't know shit about the Shirt Tales.
There's so many Shirt Tales jokes.
There's a lot of Shirt Tales jokes this season.
And I'm like, Mask?
I don't know anything about, I don't know about Mask. What the fuck is that?
I only know, it was funny. I grew up right in the era where Cartoon Network was just starting off, and then its Boomerang counterpart came out.
Yeah.
So I watched a lot of shows, a lot of cartoons as a kid that were way before my time.
One of the remarkable things about the show is how many guest stars they managed to get to.
It's insane! And
huge name guest star. You'll be watching this, and you'll be like, oh, that was funny, that joke they did about so-and-so celebrity, and then you look at the end credits like, holy shit, they actually got that celebrity to voice themselves in there. How did they do that?
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think it's because, honestly, it's such a nothing of a time commitment for these celebrities.
Sure.
Come in for 2 minutes and record a line. Okay, goodbye, thank you so much. You know, like, they can do it on their way to get a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and like literally almost everybody you can think of at this point has been on Robot Chicken and continues to be. And it's one of those, you get a chance to satire yourself. You're not live doing it, so nobody really raises a stink if you're doing something, they have you doing something offensive. So what?
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. And I remember when I was younger tinkering with stop motion animation, and I am blown away by the stuff they're able to do.
Yeah.
It seems silly, but it takes a lot of fucking work to make this silly show.
They have it down to a fine art. And, the Bill and Ted's with Genghis Khan. Remember when they brought Genghis Khan and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? And if you know anything about history, you're like, he's a serial killer. What the fuck are you doing?
And a serial rapist. Most of Mongolia is just the descendants of women that he raped.
Yeah, it's like, that's one of the most evil men who's ever lived. Why would you bring him here?
But look, he's trying to chew on a baseball bat. Isn't that cute? And it's like, he's a murderer.
But there's a lot of extra features here. There's episode commentary on all 20 episodes from multiple cast and crew members. There's the making of behind the scenes look at the production of the season. There's a whole look with where they got live cameras showing a lot of the guest stars who popped in season 6, video footage from the sound booth. Look at the female members of the writing team. An interview with Robert Kirkman, who parodies himself in this episode. Which I found surprising, because I've always heard that he kind of doesn't really have a real sense of humor about himself.
It seems like they got him to bring out his sense of humor.
Yeah, there's sound booth outtakes, including line flubs. I mean, really, this is just this giant
list. This is packed with stuff.
Yeah, I was considering it's 3 hours and 42 minutes of the show itself.
Which is only a 15-minute show when it airs.
And it's on one disc.
Yeah.
Considering there's that much on one disc, and then there's just stacks of bonus. I mean, it just keeps, I'm scrolling down this list. It just keeps going.
Yeah.
How much extra features there is on this thing.
This has probably got the most special features of anything we're reviewing this week.
Yeah, probably so.
It's crazy.
So yeah, well worth your money, well worth your time. But first, don't just pick this up blind. Robot Chicken isn't for everyone. It's an acquired taste, to be sure. So, you know, tune in online somewhere, find some sketches on YouTube, check it out, see if it appeals to you. And if so, if you're like, wow, that is really funny, literally just go ahead and buy any one of the sets.
True story.
And you will enjoy the shit out of it.
Agreed. Well, from there, we're going to go to Best of the Original Evening at the Improv.
You see, now this is my generation shit, Brian.
Okay, I had Whose Line Is It Anyway, so what's this all about?
Well, okay, there are often jokes made now about, like, the beginning of, like, improv, which was always a guy standing with a brick wall behind him, right?
Mm-hmm.
That came from this show, Evening at the Improv, which when I was a kid was airing all the time. Like, I mean, literally every channel was buying the rights to this to be able to show like repeats of it. And nobody knew who most of the comedians were here at the time, but we sure know who they are now.
No joke. Just looking at that list. Jesus.
I mean, the list of people who are on this thing are just ridiculous. And it includes stuff like, I mean, there's a lot of really, really young Jerry Seinfeld stand-up, Billy Crystal, Jim Carrey as just a baby. Literally, he looks like he's 17 years old doing some really funny, I mean, like, really shockingly funny physical comedy. Paul Reiser, Bill Maher. Oh, my God. Bill Maher, and he's so nervous. It's so funny. He's like really nervous. You can tell.
I don't want to offend anyone.
lots of big comedians, but also, they would always get like slightly bigger names, like actors and classic people to come on and be like the host for the show each week. And there's a whole list of Leslie Nielsen, William Shatner, Fred Willard, all sorts of people coming in and doing that.
Wow.
Now, the coolest thing about this 12 hours of this on these discs is that it's broken up on each disc. So instead of having to just watch an episode, you just click on the comedian whose bits you want to see.
Oh, nice.
Which is, I've never seen anybody do with this sort of set. You're like, I just want to see the Jerry Seinfeld bits. And bang, there's just the Jerry Seinfeld bits.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. I don't want to watch all that. I don't need to see the credits 80 times. I don't need to, like, to get to the stuff I want to see fast forward through two comics I've never heard of. I want to, you know, you want to flip around to some extent, but you want to see who you want to see. You want to say, oh, come on, check out the early stuff from Michael Keaton. And there you go. You can just find it immediately. So really a damn good set, all things considered, for this set. Like I said, if you're from my generation, you're like in your late 30s, early 40s, you'll remember this stuff growing up and you'll be shocked how much of this stuff you'll be watching going, oh my God, I had no idea that was that guy. I've been telling that joke for 25 years. Yeah, there's like little points, like turns of phrase I use that I had no idea had come from jokes I had heard on here when I was like a teenager.
Sure.
It's like really startling. And now I have to reevaluate my entire lexicon.
Oh no. Existential crisis.
I know.
What
right?
do we do?
I'm just not funny. Those guys were the funny ones.
We are comedy sponges. Well, moving on from there, we're going to talk about Zombie Hunter.
Do we have to?
I don't know. You put it on the list. So.
Fuck.
Oh God. It's a Danny Trejo movie.
Damn right. It's a Danny Trejo movie.
No disrespect to Mr. Trejo, who, even though he is 69 years old, could easily kick my ass into oblivion. But, dude, please stop with the direct-to-video movies already.
He's 69. He got a really late start to his career. It's
because he was in prison.
It's because he was an actual murderous criminal. He isn't that great of an actor. He knows how to scowl really well and is convincing. We love the way he looks.
He's a great henchman.
He's a great henchman. But at this point, I guess he's gone, well, fuck it. I am old. I never made any money before this because I was in jail. And I'm going to take every cent I can get in what little time I have left, which means this is one of like 10 Danny Trejo films that have come out this year.
If you go to IMDb and look at his stuff that's coming out, it looks like most people's like 30 years worth of you know, movies they've made.
And it's almost all garbage like Zombie Hunter, quite frankly. It's just this either stuff that he's just got, they paid him to do a cameo appearance in so they can put him prominently on the cover, or one like this where he is in it a bit more. I mean, he's certainly not the primary character by any stretch of the imagination, but you're like, this is garbage. This is direct-to-video garbage that somebody put in because they knew how to use an editing suite and do real basic CG effects. and had a little bit of money from daddy to spend and thought they'd make some cash. And sure enough, there are frat boys out there who will rent this just because Danny Trejo's on it and it's going to make its money back, what little it probably spent on it. The idea here is there's a lone wolf, a road warrior type after the zombie apocalypse has happened, who drives his badass car around the wasteland. When he ends up getting shot at and his car flips by, it's never really quite clear what the fuck, why this guy shot at his car. It's just a plot thing that had to happen.
It just happens.
By a group of survivors, tough survivors, and they nurse him back to health, and then basically try and convince him to help them because said, look, we can't stay here for long. Will you please help us go on to the next, you know, if we can just get past the next town, which is overrun, not just with zombies, but with humans who've gone crazy and turned into cannibals. Yada, yada, yada. Terrible special effects. This competition going on for his affection between the nice, sweet girl who looks like Marianne from Gilligan's Island and the slutty stripper girl who looks nothing like Ginger from Gilligan's Island, but she looks like barbed wire is what she looks like. And it's not what I would describe as a plot. And even the effects are terrible and just everything. Look, everything about this is somebody ripping off better films that do this sort of thing that still were films that sucked.
Well, fair.
Somebody saw Machete and said, man, I'm going to make a movie like that.
I can make that. That's terrible.
You had the wrong instincts, brother.
Whoops.
I'm just saying. What the fuck? Why do I keep watching these movies they send me with Danny Trejo in them?
I don't know.
I should know better by now. They keep sending them. I keep not asking for them specifically because I don't want to see them. But then they get here and I'm like, I just got to know.
Well, that was Zombie Hunter.
That's just, there's like, oh, no. Just don't, okay? Just don't.
Okay. Well, from there, why don't we talk about, this is actually one I'm really excited to talk about, and that is Resolution, which is an indie, I guess you'd call it a horror film, more of like an indie.
I would call it a horror film.
An indie horror film from 2012 that I actually saw at Fantasia, not this previous summer, but the summer before.
You son of a bitch.
I really, really like this movie. This is a very low budget movie, a very small, compact movie, but it's got a great story behind it.
It's a strange story.
Yeah, it's basically the main plot here is this is really a two person setup, is that you have a guy who's driving out to this, what we're thinking is a cabin to see his friend. And what it really is it's an abandoned house where his friend is squatting and doing a lot of crystal meth. And this guy has gone out there to try and force a detox on his friend and get him to get over his addiction to crystal meth.
Handcuffing him to the wall of this burnout old shack he's staying in.
And that's the setup. But from there, weird shit starts to happen as the friend who comes out there to help detox his friend finds this box of, I believe they're photographs at first. It starts off very, very low tech.
Indistinct photos.
Indistinct photos of some really weird shit. And from there he finds recordings, and from there he finds films, and things just get weirder, and as the technology of what he finds advances, things get progressively weirder. And that's really all you need to know going into this, because where the story goes is what's so fascinating about the movie, and what elevates it from a lot of the direct-to-video, independent stuff that we would see a lot, to something that's really impressive.
I would argue that the script, which actually is really interesting, outshines significantly the quality of the acting in the film, which I found to be problematic. The character trying to play the crack addict is trying to channel Tyler Labine the whole time, like very clearly, and he's not doing a very good job.
See, I couldn't disagree more. I thought he was extremely natural and extremely affable because of how genuine he was. But I guess I can kind of see what you're saying, but I did not have that problem.
Whereas I found his friend, the primary actor, to just be kind of dull. But that being said, this is a terrific script. It is one of those that the resolution, if you will, is left intentionally vague, which is going to frustrate the fuck out of some people. And I certainly, even when I was watching about this and thinking about this after, I'm like, wow, you know what? There's only one film I can really compare this to, and I hate to do it, but it's The Blair Witch Project. It really is like a much better thought out Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, but then again, But I guess I'm one of those people that doesn't find the ending of the Blair Witch Project to be that frustrating. I feel like the ending of the Blair Witch Project is pretty much how it needed to end.
It's not so much that it's frustrating, it's that the movie never... I don't like that movie at all. I think it never delivers on its promises. It starts to tease that it's going to give you something, and there's never enough to make your experience worth it, including the end. Here, it gives you a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you get more than enough stuff for it to be genuinely really freaky as it goes along, as it's clear something's going on that is beyond the rules of regular reality.
Entirely.
And as it... The plug gets thicker as the possibilities expand as to what could this possibly be. You get more and more drawn into the story. Like I said, I wasn't thrilled with the acting, but the lines they wrote for them were great. It was like enough that I was like, okay, I can get past that because I'm fascinated by the dynamic that does exist between these characters regardless and how it evolves as they start to become aware that there is indeed something truly distressing and paranormal, I guess, for lack of a better word, going on. I couldn't stop thinking about the ending of this, of trying to figure out what was that? What happened? Because you don't really know, but it's really startling and it sticks with you.
Yeah, and it's got so many great twists and turns, despite being, again, a very compartmentalized, a very small movie. It still will have you thrilled by all these different places that it goes to unexpectedly. And yeah, I thought this was a really cool... I mean, I hesitate to use the word festival film because I feel like for a lot of people that has a negative connotation. But if you've ever actually been to a film festival, there's a lot of great shit that you see there that unfortunately sometimes you just never see anywhere else. And I'm glad that Cinedigm has actually put this out because I was afraid that I would never see it again.
Yeah, it is a film that I you know, having seen it, I'm like, wow, I'm really startled actually that this came out as soon as it did after its festival release.
Yeah.
It seems like one of those movies that could have gotten lost in the mix.
Definitely. I think it's something you should check out if you're someone who's kind of maybe gotten bored with some of the tropes that are going on in horror right now and want to see something a little bit different, definitely check this out.
This is a little bit different.
Yeah. And if you're a person who likes your film to have a lot of mystery to it, definitely check this out.
True.
All right. From there, we're going to talk about Static.
Now, Static is another one of those festival films, but one that was released to considerably less acclaim than Resolution. And honestly, I can track all the problem with this film to 5 seconds in the very beginning of it, where they quite plainly show you what the giant twist is that the whole movie depends on you not knowing for the film to be effective at all. So basically...
Poor editing.
As long as you come in late to this film, you might really enjoy this movie.
I mean, it's one of the weirdest recommendations I think we've ever made.
Well, because the thing is, ultimately, I like the concept of this movie a lot, as it turns out, when it gets to, like, the reveal of what's actually happening here. I'm like, wow, that's actually a pretty cool idea. And the way it all plays out is cool, if not a little bit overly happy with its own sense of being moribund and, like, dour. You know, it's like trying to be gothic in its way, and it gets...
You're describing a lot of British films I've seen.
Well, it gets... Except, you know, definitely doesn't have a British feel to it, you know? It's American gothic, if you will.
Okay.
No pitchforks.
No pitchforks. But, no farmer's wives.
This has got a Milo Ventimiglia...
Oh, that guy from Heroes.
The guy from Heroes who probably never should have done anything else, but...
Yeah, if you've seen That's My Boy, he definitely shouldn't have done anything else.
You know, he's not the world's worst actor, but he's certainly not anywhere near the best. He and Stara Shaw, who you may know from the show Person of Interest, I don't because I haven't seen that show, but I know it's a popular show. Apparently, they're reeling from the death of their little boy. They've got all this marital dysfunction. They fight, but they're basically just left in a case of shell shock all the time. And they're interrupted when a frightened young woman, Sarah Paxton, from the remake of Last House on the Left, shows up saying that these guys with gas masks showed up and have chased her from her car, which got a flat tire, and she's really freaked out. Like, there are a bunch of them. They're out there. I don't know who they are. Can you please help me and let me in? Problem is, almost immediately when she gets there, there's little weird things about her behavior as they're talking to her and dealing with her. She's just a little bit off, and the wife is more suspicious than the husband is, but it doesn't take long before the guys in gas masks show up. She disappears, and it's not clear at all what's really going on, because the gas mask guys seem to be doing much more of just sort of watching than doing anything like attacking at all. And you're like, why are they there? What is the point of their existence? Well, the twist in this movie is figuring out what the reasoning is. And like I said, if you watch the first 10 seconds or so of this movie and you were paying attention at all, you pretty much can piece it together pretty simply. But if you weren't, I really don't. They must have gotten that criticism in theaters. They must have.
Yeah.
And like a lot. I don't understand why you wouldn't edit that little tiny bit out when you re-released it on home video. I really don't know what they were thinking.
But, the importance of a good editor illustrated right here.
Yeah. Or just of like people who aren't afraid to listen to critics and go, and everyone, I'm sure audiences in general went, what the fuck? But it's, like I said,
in my professional opinion, what the fuck?
It ended up being such a neat idea, a neat sort of a different take on an old idea, very different take on an old idea that I still enjoyed it for what it was worth. There's a lot of problems with cinematography in here, mainly that they just have no clue how to film in darkness.
Hmm.
When somebody can't make that work, it makes it where a film can be kind of boring to watch because you're like, I can't tell what's going on.
Yeah, you either strain your eyes or you just get bored.
Yeah, and part of the problem might be that this was shot in 3D. And in fact, the disc comes with a Blu-ray, 3D Blu-ray and a regular Blu-ray.
Why would they shoot this in 3D?
I don't know. There's not a lot about it that really calls for it to be in 3D either. So I have no idea.
Well, that would explain why it's so dark.
Yeah.
In those moments.
But honestly, I think it's one of those films that it's probably going to have some fans out there who like it, who are really going to get off on the twist, are really going to enjoy what it was. And a lot of people are just going to be like, wow, that was kind of a lame payoff, all things considered, that it was really hard not to see coming. But, I kind of come in between those things.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that was Static. And now, Chris, I would very like, blah, blah, blah. I would very much like you to reveal the secret of Crickley Hall.
Oh, thank God. I can talk about a good one now.
Oh, good.
I actually just loaned this to Jason Murphy because I know his lady, Allison, loves the very gothic ghost stories from Britain. And this is actually a really damn good one.
Nice.
Written by James Herbert, but not that James Herbert.
Not that James.
Not the Dune James Herbert. Another dead British writer. Apparently he was a big writer. I didn't know there was more than one. Well, I think I would change my name. That's all I'm saying.
Maybe a little bit.
But the idea here is set in 2006. It follows the events of this family who rent this huge old crickety building, Crickley Hall, because, Gabe, played by Tom Ellis, who's a television actor you've probably seen in lots of stuff, including appearance on Doctor Who in the past. He gets a short contract in the area. The other reason they go out there is because they just need to get away because their young son was abducted, like basically right in front of the mother, who was so overworked that she fell asleep when she was supposed to be watching him and somebody ran off with him. But she and the son always had a psychic connection, and she hasn't felt it for like a year and it started to give up that there was any chance he was still alive until she gets to Crickley Hall when voices start telling her that her son is still alive. Now, the thing is that, Crickley Hall is really haunted. It's haunted as fuck, yo. I mean, there's just ghosts all up in this bitch.
It's super haunted to the max.
Yeah. American Horror Story's like, what the fuck? and it all stems back to the fact that it used to be an orphanage that apparently everyone in died when there was a giant flood some years back and all the kids died in their sleep.
Well, shit. That's a recipe for a haunted house.
Yeah. Even worse than that, though, that you've got all these kid ghosts running around, you wouldn't think that's so bad, but the person who ran the school was a son of a bitch who was basically a complete sadist, and his ghost haunts it, too. And basically, anytime someone starts getting close to bits and pieces of the truth, a spectral cane comes up and whacks him on the hand.
That's annoying. Quit doing that.
As ghosts go, he's a real dick. And this flashes back and forth from the period of time when the orphanage was running and all these people were alive and following that storyline to modern day and them trying to piece together the events of what actually happened in the past as all is not as it seems. There's a mysterious old groundsman played by David Warner running around who definitely knows more than he's willing to say. Really creepy, very effective, fun twists. You know, certainly nothing wildly original in the sense of like, hey, people move into a haunted house, find out that there's a history that they have to look up a bunch of shit to figure out what that history is, and find out that the history isn't what they think the history is, so they can give the ghost what they want so they can pass on. We've seen this type of story before, but rarely done as well and as intricately as this is. It's spread out. This was originally done for TV, and it's done as a miniseries with 3-hour-long episodes. Ultimately, I was just totally glued to the screen for the whole thing. As a lover of the sort of gothic ghost dramas, this is one of the better ones I've seen in some time. Really recommend it for Game of Thrones fan. The actress who plays what's her name, Maisie Williams, I believe, is on that show as Arya Stark.
Arya, yeah.
Yeah, she plays one of the girls in the family who are staying at the house in here. I was like, wait, it's that girl.
Very
cool. It's that same girl. If you watch a lot of British television, you'll recognize a lot of the actors in here from here and there, basically. But overall, really fun, very creepy. Good times.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm going to check this out. This sounds awesome. So from there, this brings us sort of to our last couplet of reviews that are sort of one themselves, and that is Chucky, the Complete Collection, as well as Curse of Chucky, which is part of the Complete Collection, but also sold separately.
In the unlikely occasion that you already own Chucky 1 through 5 on Blu-ray, you can always buy Chucky 6 separately.
There you go. They're making it easy for you to own all of the Child's Play films.
Now, Child's Play, which is only the first three are called Child's Play.
That's true.
The rest of them all have like, they left it out of the title. And actually there was a specific reason for that, because the first three dealt with him versus a child.
Yeah.
And that kid has nothing to do with the next three, or at least largely anyway.
Andy's not really involved.
Did you watch The Stinger in 6?
The Stinger?
Oh, you didn't stay till after the credits.
Oh no.
Oh yeah. We'll have to watch that before you leave.
Okay. That makes sense, because I was seeing a name in the credits and I was like, I didn't see him in the movie.
Yeah.
Now I know.
There's a stinger at the very end of the credits that's very much a do not miss sequence. But
which is funny because the ending of Curse of Chucky has like what feels like 3 post-credit stingers as the ending of the film.
And in fact, the stinger at the very end makes absolutely no sense considering the actual end of the film. You're like, wait, but why would that be? Did the thing he was trying to do not work then? What? It doesn't make sense. But
if you're listening at home, yes, this is us looking for internal logic in a Chucky film.
Yeah, well, you know what? We do what we can. But, you know, the Child's Play films, say what you will about them, they were very popular. The idea of Brad Dourif is a serial killer whose soul, because he has a knowledge of black magic and a powerful amulet, as he shot to death in a toy store, injects his soul into one of these popular dolls at the time, the Cabbage Patch Kid of its time.
The Good Guy Doll.
The Good Guy Doll, ironically.
Ironic.
Comes to life and starts basically haunting, trying to kill the kid he was given to, Andy, over the space of 3 movies, which he failed at miserably. Spoiler.
Yeah, the MO is basically the same. It's kill a bunch of people, make it look like the kid did it, and then try to put your soul into a different child or that child.
Now, when they went to Bride of Chucky and then after that Seed of Chucky, the director, Don Mancini, and the writer, who I'm not sure if they're separate people or not, but I know it was the same writer and director for all of them.
Well, no, Ronnie Yu actually directed Bride of
Chucky.
You're right.
I'm sorry. But Don Mancini was the main, went back and did
Don sets, Mancini, so. I believe, was actually, though, the writer of Even Still, if I'm not mistaken, was the writer of even, Bride of Chucky. Which,
yes, he did them all. He wrote every single one of them.
Yeah, that was actually a really interesting thing that no other franchise had rebooted itself the same way that the Child's Play franchise did, which was to bring in another killer to partner up with the main antagonist of the series.
And drastically change the entire tone of the type of film.
Yeah.
Because while the first 3 films certainly had comedic elements, I mean, how can you not with a killer doll?
Yeah.
Unless your Trilogy of Terror, which is not funny. Going completely for humor. I mean, it goes from horror with little bits of comedy to flat-out comedy horror with Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky, which certainly did not find favor with fans of the first 3 films of this series. That being said, I wasn't a fan of the first 3 films in the series, and I really like the change into comedy with Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky. I know an opinion you don't share.
Well, no, that's
a lot of people don't.
No. But see, again, don't misquote me.
Okay,
I like Bride of Chucky a lot, and I only like the first 2. I like Child's Play 1 and 2. I was a fan of those movies. I'm not a big fan of 3, but I loved what they did with Bride of Chucky, which completely turned things on this is a franchise that had gotten really stale even after 3 movies.
True.
And if they had kept with the same formula, they wouldn't have been able to do anything with it. So Ronnie Yu and Don Mancini coming in and doing something as bizarre as making Jennifer Tilly this other serial killer who Charles Lee Ray used to pal around with,
yeah,
and then making her another like that's really interesting and fun.
And the animatronics on the dolls got a lot better.
Oh, totally.
In Bride of Chucky. Like from there on, you're like, wow, these are so much higher quality with what they're doing because it really became much more of a puppeteer's movie.
Yeah,
you know, you're like, wow, they have to do really elaborate stuff like masturbate and have sex.
And there's some CG, but one of the things I've always liked about this franchise is it necessitates a lot of practical effects, whether that's forced perspective, whether that's puppeteering.
Yeah.
It's just really cool what they're able to do with it to bring Chucky to life.
Now, Seed of Chucky, admittedly, is much more campy and silly than Bride of Chucky. And I know you said you didn't like
that's the one I don't like.
You're like, look, I get that it's still a comedy, just like Bride of Chucky, but it's not funny. I actually found it funnier than Bride of Chucky myself. Yeah. But it's just, you know, comedy is subjective. What are you going to do?
And it's comedy within a horror franchise, which is the other really subjective thing.
It's very meta because, like, even though Jennifer Tilly appeared as, you know, live action in Bride of Chucky playing a completely different person, and here she Seed of Chucky she appears as Jennifer Tilly,
which is a really cool twist. I did like that. She's like the doll Tiffany wants to put her soul into Jennifer Tilly because she's such a big fan, which is funny because she is Jennifer Tilly. Yeah. And they keep making jokes about,
she's got the most beautiful voice I've ever heard.
And there's lots of little, like, there's so many horror references in these that I didn't get a lot of them. And I watch a lot of horror. I was like, holy shit.
The one part of Seed of Chucky that did make me laugh out loud was right at the end when Chucky knocks down a portion of the door with an axe, puts his face up to it, and you're just waiting for him to say, here's Chucky. And he goes, I don't have anything to say right now.
I can't think of what to say.
Can't think of anything to say. Damn it.
Yeah, there's lots of referencing like that. And sometimes it's just a little too broad. But overall, I enjoyed it for what it was. And I actually really liked the ending, which I thought was appropriately ridiculously goofy. Now, Curse of Chucky is their attempt to sort of – it almost teases the audience with it being a reboot. It's not.
No.
But it almost it wants you to believe for a while they've rebooted the series. And one of the keys to Curse of Chucky working on some level is that how in the hell are they going to tie this into the previous films? And the cleverness is how, in fact, they do that.
Yeah.
As it goes along, bit by bit, we start to understand the ways in which this is directly connected to everything we've seen happen already. I found myself more interested in anything with that. That being said, the first half of this is, I found to be just like the first three films in a lot of ways, better filmed and with some damn good cinematography at moments, even.
Yeah.
Great location, big old gothic mansion that a woman lives in who's wheelchair bound since birth. So they've got one of those old school lifts in the thing, you know, where you have to pull the lever to make it go up. You're like,
creepiest elevator ever.
Yeah, seriously. And, you know, lots of cool stuff like that going on around it. But the story is very like run of the mill Chucky.
It's basic Chucky. I won't argue with that. But again, I think the dividing line here is whether or not you were a fan of – I won't even say the first three because the third one is so whacked. If you're a fan of the first two Child's Play movies, I think this is going to be one that you like more.
Yeah.
Because it is. You're right. It is trying to kind of recapture what was going on in the first two movies. And then it brings in the added mythology in a really cool way of the last two movies. And I've got to see the stinger. Now I'm really interested.
Yeah, it pays off pretty well on the whole. I think that like this actually builds to a point. You're like, if you enjoy the series in general, the whole series, you're going to be very happy with where this ends up going. And yeah, like there's a really fun stinger at the very end. Even if it makes no sense contextually, it's still like, okay, they had to do that at some point. But yeah, I mean, I do. I really recommend this. I'm not even like, I'm far from what I would consider a big fan of Chucky or the Child's Play movies, but Curse of Chucky is kind of a, like we haven't given up on the comedy aspect as much as they make you think they have at first, but it's kind of a nice blending of the two types of films.
For the first half of the movie, I will tell you exactly what it felt like to me was a really well-produced fan film. It felt like somebody who had gotten a hold of either the rights or their own good guy doll and were like, oh, well, this is a story I would tell. And it's intriguing on that level. And then once they actually do get into where it's like, okay, now it's very clearly part of the Chucky universe, I think is where it gets even better. But I had a lot of fun with Curse of Chucky, a lot more than I ever thought that I would.
Yeah.
So I did really enjoy it. And you're right, the way it ties back into the original story is so great. And I love that Brad Dourif is still willing and you know, and loves to still do this character, because honestly, if it weren't for Brad Dourif, this franchise would be nothing.
Yeah, probably true.
He is the most – He's the best part of the series by far, and his daughter is the lead in this film.
Yeah. It was really nice to actually see Brad Dourif again, like, as a live-action person at points in the sixth one, who, don't worry, nothing, like, it's not a drastic change to the plot. It's flashbacks.
Yeah.
But, like, and it's also appropriate for this film. It goes all the way back to the beginning in some ways. Like, you know the beginning of Jackie? You never saw everything that happened.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I admit, I'm one of those people, I kind of like it when horror movies do
that. I do too.
Yeah.
I enjoy that. I enjoy expanding the universe a little bit, expanding the mythology.
Now, this whole set comes with a pretty decent amount of bonus features on every disc, and the Czechy guys love to do stuff for laughs with bonus features. There's always stuff they were putting together for television shows and stuff where it's like, okay, let's bring out Czechy and let's bring out, was it Tiffany?
Tiffany, yeah.
You know, have them do goofy stuff and make horror puns. It's like the Crypt Keeper here somewhere, probably. No, he's writing for them. And it's fun to watch that stuff. You're like, okay, that's kind of cool. They put all that stuff together. And the new one's no exception. The new one comes with R-rated and an unrated cut, which I'm not sure why, considering it did not get a theatrical release. So
yeah, that always, like, this isn't the first movie that's done that, where it's like, this is the unrated cut of this direct-to-video movie. I'm like, where did the rated cut play that you needed to release it?
Well, like, even weirder to have both versions on here. You're like, why would you even want an R-rated
one?
Cut? Oh, I've got this for my kids who love Chucky, but I don't want them seeing anything too bloody. Look, stop.
Very arbitrary.
But yeah, it's got lots of, you know, the how they did it, put it together. And this has actually got some interesting effects stuff. As you'll see once you start watching it, I really don't want to spoil anything here, but suffice it to say, the Chucky that you're used to seeing, expect some big changes and that will freak you out and make you go, what's going on here? All will be explained.
Indeed. Well, that actually brings us to the title that's going to be our giveaway. And that is Curse of Chucky on Blu-ray.
Hooray.
It's Halloween, or it's October. We're still giving away horror films. I'm so glad it's worked out that that's what we've been able to do all month.
Me too.
So happy. And as you well know, if you've been listening to the show, we've moved away from a fastest finger who can see what quickest type of giveaway prompt. And instead, we're giving you a creative writing prompt to come up with a couple sentences, a paragraph, whatever. And we just choose our favorites. And that lets you use your imagination a little bit more. And yeah, I like it better. I don't know about you guys, but
I'm very happy with it. It makes it fun for us to pick a winner.
Yeah, and it makes the comment sections a lot of fun to go back and read. Agreed. So thank you guys for contributing to that. And
did you have a plan for this one?
I do.
Okay, I love it when you come in with a plan.
Okay.
I love it when a plan comes together.
I love it when a plan comes together. And for this one, I want you to tell us, and this could be a completely true story or bullshit, we'll never know, but I want you to tell us, as a child, what toy did you have that you always had a sneaking suspicion was evil? Like, you'd play with it during the day, and then nighttime rolls around, you're like, no, lock it in the toy, no, lock the toy box. I don't want to see it.
Did it have to be your toy?
It didn't have to be your toy.
My mother had this weird long plastic thing.
Okay. No. Not the special back massager.
Sometimes late at night I could hear it.
Nope. No. It doesn't have to necessarily be your toy. If your sibling had something and you were forced to look at it as you were trying to fall asleep, or if you slept over at somebody's house and they had something. Some toy that crossed your path in childhood that you were like, that's a cool toy, but you're always kind of convinced was evil incarnate. So that is going to be the prompt. Write that in the comments section, and we'll pick our two favorites, and each of them will receive a Blu-ray copy of Curse of Chucky.
Damn right you will.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode.
Damn it. See, I hate it, though, because every end of a Digital Noise episode in October means we're that much closer to October being over.
Yeah.
And I don't like it.
That does suck.
I vote we just go call the rest of, like, all from now on, it's just October.
Octvember?
Yeah.
Octcember?
Exactly.
Totally. We could totally do this.
Yep. Every day is Halloween, my friends.
Yay!
Every day is Halloween.
I love it. I love that we live in that tree in the Nightmare Before Christmas universe where every day is Halloween. Hooray. Well, yeah, I want to remind you guys once again, please do nominate us for the Podcast Awards at podcastawards.com. Please go ahead and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/digitalnoise.oneofus. And also follow us on Twitter. You can also follow One of Us itself at facebook.com/oneofusnet. You can follow us on Twitter. The show is at DigiNoiseCast. That's D-I-G-I NoiseCast. You can follow me at BryGuySalisbury.
I'm at ChrisCoxCritic.
And you can find all of our shows on iTunes, where you can give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. I'm pretty sure that covers everything, except if you've enjoyed any of the titles that we've talked about on this show, please consider using our links below to get to Amazon and buy that, because that supports the site. Or, if you get to Amazon via our links, it doesn't matter what you buy, you're still supporting the site. So please do that.
And in advance, thank you.
Thank you so
much.
Very
nice, and I think about you all the time. Sometimes when I'm alone at night with my mom's toy.
Anywho, that's going to do it for Digital Noise. But until next time, remember, always check under the bed for Chris's mom's toy.